Jason Taylor, an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy at the University of Utah, says that in good times, higher education gets revenue from the state. But in bad economic times,
higher education loses a lot because it competes with K-12 education funding, it competes with healthcare, it competes with criminal justice, other social services. And frankly, higher education has another revenue source in tuition and private dollars that these other sectors don't have as much of.
The problem is, increasingly, colleges and universities are asking students and their families to foot more of the bill through tuition. And that's making college unaffordable. About 7 in 10 seniors who graduated this past spring borrowed for their educations, and an estimated 40 million Americans have school loan debt. Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, we'll learn about efforts in different states to make college affordable again. That's coming up after this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. Do you have college loan debts? If you said yes, then you're not alone. Different surveys over the past year suggest recent college graduates owe between an average of $29,000 to $37,000 in student loan debt. About 7 in 10 seniors who graduated this past spring borrowed for their educations. An estimated 40 million Americans have school loan debts. However, statistics show that new college graduates are finding jobs with salaries at a decent amount, above what they owe in student debt. So their debts are manageable by some estimates. But increasingly, college no longer feels affordable for many, many American families, especially many low-income and middle-income students. So, is college worth it anymore? Are Americans losing faith in college? Is higher education a public good or a private good? And who should pay for college and why? These are the key questions that Jason Taylor has set out to understand. Jason is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy at the University of Utah, and he researches the so-called free college movement and current efforts to make college more affordable. During this hour, he'll also talk about the intersection of how universities and community college policies impact social and educational inequality. Later in the program, you'll also learn about policy efforts to make community college free again, including efforts here in Salt Lake to make Salt Lake Community College essentially free for students who meet certain academic goals and requirements. Here is Professor Jason Taylor.
By a show of hands, how many of you are undergraduate or graduate students here? Can you sort of raise your hand and hold them high? Okay, great. Okay, so maybe, keep them up for me, please. Maybe 80 to 90% of you. Keep your hand raised if you think college is affordable. Generally, would you agree college is affordable? Raise your hand. Okay, we've got maybe 3% of people. Okay, great. Okay, and raise your hand if you think you'll graduate from college with any student loan debt. Go ahead and raise your hand again. With student loan debt. Yes. Okay, so maybe 70% or so. So I think this illustrates part of the problem here in relation to college affordability and free college, partially a perception problem that college is unaffordable, as well as this increasing burden of paying for college, which is on the responsibility of students and families. So I want to share this quote from a student here, because fundamentally I think we really need to situate this in students' perceptions and experiences and listen to their voices as we make policy decisions. So this was part of this study I'm working on at Salt Lake Community College, and we asked this student, who is a Pell Grant recipient, a low-income student, when you think about all of your financial obligations, how does it make you feel? The student says, so stressed out. That's kind of frustrating. That's kind of the frustrating thing about going to school. Even though we make the idea, the recession definitely scared me. The idea of making more money in the long run, getting our bachelor's degree, is kind of rewarding. But because of the recession, what happens if we don't make more money in the long run? And we are stuck with a 12 to 13 hour job trying to pay off this loan. That's what keeps me up at night. So there's a lot of layers to this quote, some of which we'll touch on today, weighing the costs and benefits of college, considering future job prospects and income, the fear of loan debt, and really the stress and anxiety that is affiliated with paying for college. And so when we look at survey data and we ask students why they aren't enrolled in college anymore, why they stopped out of college, the number one reason is personal reasons. The number two reason is financial reasons. And certainly those are coupled because a lot of personal reasons are due to family obligations or work, several financial related obligations. So that's the student perspective. So we probably all remember from the recent election that we had a couple candidates that really promoted and elevated free college in their national platform. And as you can see by this sort of spread of reactions here, the reactions were many. The plans sort of evolved over time, but they really elevated in the public consciousness, I think, this idea of free college. But the idea of free college, it seems sort of new to us. It's actually not that new. For a long time, community colleges were free. In states like California, they used to be completely free. So why is that? Why were some colleges free? And it leads me to sort of a question that I want to frame my remarks around, and a question I ask every year in my class, in my higher education finance class, and that's who should pay for college and why? And I'm not sure we're going to answer all of those questions today, but I'm at least going to give you some food for thought, some things to think about some dimensions of these questions. But I really want to argue that free college and the promise movement is the latest manifestation of public policies that really impact this question, who pays for college? And I see this free college movement in some places as a reinvestment in higher education, sometimes a public reinvestment, sometimes a private reinvestment, sometimes it comes from public dollars and sometimes it comes from private dollars, but really it's a reinvestment. So a little disclaimer here, because I think when we talk about finance, you know, we sort of think of higher education as a business, and I think there are some similarities to the private sector, and there are some really important differences. One of the similarities is that, you know, the work that we do as faculty and staff is not really free, right? Someone has to pay for it, and institutions have budgets that really need to be healthy in order for the institution to sustain itself. So it's really important that we think about higher education in economic ways, even though we, for those of us in education, you know, we feel like we're really diminishing what it is that higher education does. On the other hand, you know, there's some really important differences, including the purpose and the motives of higher education, which are not entirely economic, although sometimes you might argue they are, but they really aren't. So this forum this talk is about affordability and finance, but I want to frame it in part from a non-economic perspective, because I think as we talk about the financing and economics of higher education, we really need to have the non-economic perspective in our mind here. So we've seen recently a lot of concern about higher education, and here's a few headlines that we see in the news: public perceptions questioning the value of higher education. And it's often there's Peter Thiel up there. Some of you might have heard about his idea, and he moved forward with it to pay people not to go to college to do maybe entrepreneurial types of activities. But oftentimes the resistance is framed around cost, right? Because the cost has gone up so much over the past couple decades. And one of the reasons I think this is a concern is that our institutions and our leaders really have lost sight of the purposes and benefits and value of higher education. Or if they haven't lost sight of them, I don't think they're communicating them very well or articulating them very well. So let's talk quickly about just the purpose of public higher education. So David Labrie traced the public purposes of education broadly. And one of those purposes is democratic equality. So if you look back to sort of the common school movement in the early 1900s, this was sort of the Horace Mann vision for education and public education, that it would be training for citizenship and that we'd really be preparing all members of a society to participate in society and engage in a democratic society and democratic activities. And I think we've lost sight of this in public education and particularly in higher education. There was a paper at a conference last year. It was a rhetoric analysis of governor's state of the state addresses, and they looked at you know, how did governors and, you know, in this case, the leader of a state talk about higher education. And this vision for higher education was completely absent from their rhetoric. It was purely economic, conceptualized in terms of jobs and the economy, which is sort of another purpose, right? The individual purpose and benefits, job preparation, training, personal development, social mobility, and of course these extend to society as well in terms of productivity and so forth from an economic perspective. So the fundamental question really is, to what extent is higher education a private good or a public good? And what does this mean for financing higher education? And if we can't conceptualize higher education beyond sort of a private economic perspective, then why should we invest in it? Why should we invest taxpayer dollars in it? So let's talk briefly just about these benefits. I'll start with the economic benefits just because I think many of us know them, and despite the sort of public perceptions, we've got really a lot of good economic evidence on the benefits to individuals from an economic and employment perspective. In 2016, the employment rate for those with a bachelor's degree was 5.2%. For those with a high school diploma was 5.2%. For those with a bachelor's degree, it was 2.7%, so an inverse relationship between unemployment and education. And then with earnings, those with a bachelor's degree earn on average about double of those with a high school diploma. We see this is some work by Deming and Donarski where they sort of traced over time real earnings, so adjusting for inflation, and they found that actually they've declined quite a bit for high school graduates, and they either remain steady or increased for those with a bachelor's degree. So in the long term, the long term trend is really that the labor market favors those with a college education and a bachelor's degree. By 2020, it's projected that about 65% of our economy and our jobs will require some type of college education. So that's great news for all of you, right? If you're undergrads, stay here. Do not leave. If you want to make money, if you don't want to be employed, if you're thinking about leaving, rethink it, because it's on average, in the long run, you will benefit individually. So again, we know this is documented, and this is what policymakers and leaders tend to talk about when they talk about higher education. So what about the public benefits? One of the best pieces on this is a piece that the College Board does every year. Education pays the benefits of higher education for individuals in society. College-educated individuals have better retirement and health insurance, lower participation in public assistance programs, lower smoking rates, higher exercise rates, lower obesity rates, higher levels of civic engagement, and voter rates, right? So we see sort of economic health and sort of civic engagement participation highly correlated with education, both individually and some of these that extend to society. But even this is sort of a limited view of what higher education does, and I think the best work on this is a book about a decade ago now, but by Walt McMahon called Higher Learning, Greater Good. And what he does here is he's an economist, so he really thinks about this from an economic perspective and quantifies the social return, the social benefits of higher education, sort of the positive externalities of higher education. And he does this from a comparative international perspective where we can look at countries with different levels of education and a lot of different indices of some of the social benefits and metrics that are used, democratization and political institutions, human rights and civic institutions, political stability, life expectancy, reduced inequality, lower crime. And ultimately, he calculates that social rate of return, and it's 50%. So this is what others experience, a community, a society experiences as a result of higher education. So my point here is that as we think about and talk about affordability in higher education, we need to be able to conceptualize it beyond what an individual or the workforce might be able to gain, but we also need to think about it from sort of the social benefits, communities and societies, how they benefit. Another reason for you all to stay here, right? If you're working on your degree, right? You're going to be more likely to give back, to engage, to participate, and live in and be part of communities and help develop and those communities. And you might be more happy as well, right? You might be happier, right?
Jason Taylor is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy at the University of Utah. He researches the so-called free college movement and current efforts to make college more affordable. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCBW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures and debates and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah, and we replay them as a public service. Today, we are airing a talk given a couple weeks ago about efforts happening in different states to make college more affordable. An estimated 40 million Americans have school loan debt. On average, recent college graduates have debts around $30,000 or more, and for many, well, that's just not affordable anymore, especially if the job you get afterward doesn't pay all that well. Well, recently, Jason Taylor, an assistant professor of education who researches college affordability, spoke about why it matters that college be affordable for most Americans and what different states and schools are trying to do about it.
Okay, so this is a good segue into affordability here. So the question is, who has access to higher education, and what role does affordability and finance play? So no doubt we've made significant gains broadly in access and success in higher education for those, particularly for those who historically have not had access. But there's still significant gaps by income, by race. So the benefits are not really, the benefits that we just, you know, that I just talked about are really not equally distributed, right? Because of what I'm gonna show you, which is that the educational outcomes of students based on their social background are not equally distributed. So this is, I think, one of the best data points for this, which is based on a longitudinal study by the National Center for Education Statistics and sort of nationally representative data, longitudinal surveys that the Department of Education conducts. And so what you see here is bachelor degree completion rates. You might not be able to read this. Bachelor degree completion rates by math achievement quartile in your sophomore year of high school. As measured in your sophomore year of high school, and your economic background, your socioeconomic status. So the chart, so what we see here, and we can just sort of look at the right three bars here. This is the highest achieving, these are the highest achieving students, right? So if we sort of account for students who are at about the same level in high school as sophomore, we see that the bachelor degree completion rate for the most economic advantaged students is 74%, and for the least economic advantaged students, it's 41%. So we see a difference of 33 percentage points just in bachelor's degree outcomes. We know that by the sophomore year of high school, and actually there's other research that traces this even prior to that. Similarly, some work that's been done at Georgetown University on race and educational outcomes, post-secondary educational outcomes, this chart shows, even if we sort of look at students who perform similarly on ACT and SAT scores, there's a 20 percentage point gap between in degree completion between white students and students of color. So, you know, higher education does lead to more benefits, both economic, socially, but high-income students and white students are much more likely to benefit because they're more likely to receive a degree. So this really leads me to what role does affordability play in higher education? And to understand that, we need to understand a little bit about the revenue sources in higher education, which there are really four primary revenue sources: taxpayers, students and families in the form of tuition, private philanthropy, and auxiliary. There's a few more. These are the major ones. But really, there's three main ones, the top three ones, because a lot of auxiliary functions are sort of self-sustaining. They don't really go towards the core educational and related expenses, teaching and learning expenses. I'm going to go to this one. So this shows revenue per full-time equivalent, which is a way of sort of standardizing, two half part-time students would be equal to one full-time student, so it's a way of standardizing how much revenue institutions get by the number of students that they have. And so this displays revenue by sector and actually by source and over time. It's a little bit difficult to read, but the blue bar is net tuition. So at research, and the green bar is state and local appropriations. So this is where we get most of our funding for sort of the teaching and learning function at institutions, right? So at a public research institution like this, about half of our funding, a little bit more than that when you add on federal sources, is from half of our revenue is from these sources. At public master's and bachelor's institutions, about 75% of their revenue is from tuition and state and local appropriations. So these are places like Cal State universities in Utah, Utah Valley University, some of those institutions. And then public community colleges rely almost exclusively on tuition and state and local appropriations. And then, of course, private institutions over there, you know, they of course, get a lot from tuition and private funds. But I'm mostly focusing on public institutions for this talk. This leads me to, I think, one of sort of the most important trends and data points in the financing of public higher education. This really shows the significant state disinvestment in public higher education over the past couple decades. So the right vertical axis here is our is sort of the dollars per FTE, revenue dollars per FTE per student. The blue, the left axis is actually the number of students enrolled per FTE. The blue bar here are state higher education appropriations per FTE, and the green is net tuition. So what do you see here, right? You see over time you can see the top bar getting larger and the bottom bar getting smaller. That means institutions are, the share of their revenue from the state appropriations is declining, and the share of their revenue from tuition is increasing. So in 1990, about 75% of revenue came from the state, and now it's about 46.5% on average. This varies quite a bit by state. This just sort of shows the state distribution of that same metric. It's a low of 15% in Wyoming. They only get 15% of their funding from the state, and a high of 85% in Vermont. If you're curious, Utah's just below the average, around 45%. Another way to look at this is to look at state and local tax revenue that goes to higher education. So if we look at state budgets and the amount of tax, state and local tax revenue that they get, over the past 10 years, that's declined by about 27%. So on average, about in 2003, about 7.6% of state budgets went to higher education. Now it's about 5.5%. So this is just another way to look at that. And other research sort of shows that this is a function of what some scholars have identified as the balance wheel. Higher education really serves as a balance wheel for state budgets, which means in good economic times, higher education gets revenue from the state, but in bad economic times, during recessions, higher education loses a lot because it competes with K-12 education funding, it competes with healthcare, it competes with criminal justice, other social services, and frankly, higher education has another revenue source in tuition and private dollars that these other sectors don't have as much of. But in the long run, states lose more during the recessions that they actually get in the good times when we have a lot of state revenue. So right now, our funding to higher ed has sort of been going up because we've had a really good, a decent economy. But that's not enough to make up for how much it's been cut during recessions. So this is one really critical explanation for why tuition has gone up. So this chart shows average public average tuition at public four-year colleges and universities. About 20 years ago, if you sort of look at total cost of attendance, tuition, fees, room, and board, it's gone up from about $11,000 to $20,000. Then if you subtract out grant aid, that means that students and families at public four-year institutions have about $14,000 that's not covered by grant aid. They're responsible, on average, for about $14,000. And of course, the big, I think, headlines, this is dominating the news, you know, for quite some time. Student debt is now at about $1.3 billion. This is Federal Reserve data that just sort of shows the proportion of debt, and that red bar there is the proportion that's student loan debt. So that has increased over time. And this is obviously one of the consequences for students and families paying more tuition and fees, as well as, you know, I would argue, federal policies that have shifted the aid sort of framework for distributing aid from grants to loans. So it's also important to note, though, and I think particularly in the context of student debt, all debt is not distributed equally. And actually, you know, I think the news and policymakers like to point out these extreme cases where we have students with $100,000, $200,000 of student loan debt. There was a recent analysis using the best student loan data we have. 62% of all federal loan debt is concentrated among the top 20% of borrowers, which are more likely to go to grad school and really have jobs that provide them with great incomes. So Utah is actually among graduates, BA graduates, Utah's the lowest in terms of the average debt. It's about 20% on average are graduates in the state. Our BA graduates graduate with about 20%. So what does all of this mean for students and families? So we have a really, really robust literature that shows that particularly low-income students are more sensitive to prices, and they're more loan-averse. And this has implications for both whether students go to college, where they go to college, and how they do in college. So as prices go up, low-income students who have fewer resources in general, are much less likely to go to college. So you might have noticed, sort of, let's segue into to free college and promise programs. As I noted earlier, these programs represent what I would argue is a reinvestment, sort of rethinking a reinvestment in higher education. And I put quotes around free, not because, I mean, on the one hand, right, someone has to pay for it, and I think that's the one way people like to argue nothing's free. I mean, that's true, right? Someone has to pay for college. But I use quotes here around the term free because most of these promise programs really don't promise all that they think could or should. And we have to be cautious in our promotion of these programs because we do have some good evidence, actually, and I'll share some of that they're effective. But we need more research, particularly on what's covered, what's not, and what the programs really do. So I'm going to go through some examples here. The origin of sort of the contemporary manifestation of free college and promise programs, using that word promise, emerged out of emerged in Kalamazoo, Michigan, in about 2005. And so this was what we call a place-based program, right? In Michigan, it covered up to full tuition at any public college in Michigan. You had to be a graduate from a Kalamazoo public school. You had to be continuously enrolled since ninth grade. Now there's sort of a sliding scale. Your benefits and tuition are proportionate to your enrollment in the district. Initial eligibility, no need or merit criteria. It's what we call universal eligibility. Everyone's eligible. And this was really funded through private sources, through donors, through philanthropists, and it was really emerged out of a need to invest in the community and give and invest in Kalamazoo and invest in Michigan. So since then, and really I'd say in the last 5 years, we've really seen an emergence of these programs. The College Promise Campaign in DC is doing their best to track all of these. They say that there's about 200 or so programs around the country. You can see Salt Lake Community College on there, the one in Utah right now, and some of, you know, people have to, either the campaign identifies them or institutions or states have to upload their information, so they might not all be represented here. We've also seen a lot of action at the state level. Here's a map of states that have either passed legislation, have programs in place, or that have legislation introduced. You'll see highlighted in green, Tennessee, Minnesota, and Oregon. Particularly Tennessee and Oregon were sort of the first, Tennessee was the first sort of statewide promise program. A bill is sitting on the desk in the in California on the governor's desk to be signed to offer free college to all community colleges, college students. So sort of going back to when community college was free. So there's a lot of development at the state level in this space. So one of the really important elements of these programs is that they vary so much, and as and it's really important to think about what the programs look like and their variation. There's a new study by Laura Perna and Elaine Lee that's coming out pretty soon that takes stock of sort of the landscape of these programs and tries to cluster them together according to several different design and sort of policy design dimensions here. Their analysis, and I'm going to share just a few characteristics of what they learned, but their analysis was a little bit broader. They included 289 programs in their analysis, which included a lot of state-sponsored programs. So many of these scholarship programs that already exist in states, right? So in Utah, we have the Regent Scholarship and the New Century Scholarship, which are a sort of promise to students, right? If you do X, Y, and Z, you know, we're going to help you pay for college. I grew up in Illinois and went to college there, and we had the MAP grant. It was a need-based program, guaranteed if you enrolled in a public college. So these are included in this analysis because they are a type of promise. They just don't have the word promise in them. And actually, some of our new state policies look somewhat, and certainly local policies look somewhat similar. So I don't expect you to read this slide, but I want to highlight just a few key dimensions of these policies that are relevant in their analysis here. So about 65% don't restrict the institution for which students are eligible to receive aid. So that means about 35% do. So in other words, 65% of these generally say you can go to any college in two-year or four-year college in a state generally. The other 35% restrict eligibility. Maybe it's to one college. Maybe it's to only the two-year sector, like what's on the desk, on the governor's desk in California. Or maybe it's only to public institutions. But the majority don't restrict. In terms of eligibility, there's a lot of different eligibilities in terms of need and merit. So need in terms of a financial need, your a student's economic background, and merit in terms of however a state or institution might define merit, usually by GPA of some sort. So 36% of these are merit only. They only look at students' performance, however they measure it, GPA, ACT, SAT. 22% are need only. So the Regent Scholarship here would be a merit scholarship. Need only MAP grant, and like I mentioned in Illinois, 22% of these programs are need only programs. 18% are sort of this mix of need and merit. And 24% are universal. This is where we sort of see the Kalamazoo promise, sort of these everyone's eligible. And Tennessee, which I'll talk about. The other important dimension that I think is worth mentioning here is the financial award structure. And these are characterized by a first dollar or last dollar model. So first dollar models are ones where aid is awarded first, the aid from a program is awarded first before like Pell Grants or private scholarships. So it's more likely to cover the full or closer to the full cost of attendance, and then you add on Pell Grants, private scholarships after that. Last dollar is the opposite. Pell Grants are applied first, private scholarships are applied first, and then the program will cover the remainder. 35% of these programs are first dollar, not even full tuition, so the largest percent is the least generous in terms of how much they cover for students' total cost of attendance. 12% are first dollar full tuition, so that's the most generous, and then the remainder, a little over half, are all last dollar programs. So to give you a sense of a few of these, I'll highlight just a few more here, and then I'll share a little bit about Salt Lake Community College Promise that I've been working with my research with them on. So Pittsburgh Promise, this is another early Promise program. Similar to Kalamazoo, you have to be a graduate, you have to continuously enroll. They have a merit dimension to this that has gone up over time. They also had a minimum high school attendance requirement, sort of a behavioral requirement for students. Awarded up to $7,500 a year for 4 years in any public-private, a last dollar model. The funding source was private. Galesburg Promise, this is at Carl Sandburg College, a community college. This is my home district in Illinois. They just launched it a few years ago. Again, you have to be a local graduate, only applicable to students immediately after high school. You have to sort of enroll in 9 credits per year, sort of make progress. It awards up to full tuition. Again, a last dollar model. So after your Pell Grant or other private scholarships are applied, public and private. You might have seen in the news in the last 6 to 9 months, New York, they announced their version of Free College, the New York Excelsior program. Eligibility, again, you have to be a New York resident. It's good for any public or public 2-year or 4-year in the state. You have to be enrolled full-time. You have to basically full-time, 30 credits a year. There's a need component to this one. You have to have a gross income of $100,000 or less. That's going to go up a little bit as the program is rolled out. And the controversial part of this program is this piece where you have to live and work in New York after you graduate for the same number of years that you lived in, or that you received, that you were in college, basically receiving aid. So this is a very, very controversial part of this program. Awarded up to about $5,000 per year. Also, again, this a last dollar, and this was publicly funded. So this was in the governor's state budget.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a minute.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today we're airing a talk about the so-called free college movement and current efforts to make college more affordable. Jason Taylor, an assistant professor of education at the University of Utah, researches policy solutions to make college more affordable for most Americans. And he spoke a couple weeks ago at the Hinckley Institute of Politics.
So let me mention Tennessee Promise. This is the first statewide program launched in 2015. You have to be a recent high school grad. And they had a community service dimension. You have to serve 8 hours of community service per semester. This is a publicly funded from their lottery dollars. In this last year, it cost about $25 million. Just some outcomes. I'll zoom breeze through these because they're sort of all the same. A few programs that have been pretty sort of well established, and some people have been able to do some pretty rigorous analyses of the sort of causal estimates using quasi experimental designs of these programs. See, you know, pretty good effects on college enrollment and college outcomes. Kalamazoo Promise and Knox Achieves also found larger effects for low-income students. So this idea of telling students, you know what, college is free, that seems to have a bigger effect for low-income students. And then Tennessee Promise, this is sort of our first statewide experiment in this, conceptualized as a promise program where this was restricted to 2-year institutions only. They saw their FAFSA completion rate go up in 10 years, which means more Pell Grant money likely coming into the state. They saw the percent of students taking loans go down by 17%. This is all descriptive evidence. And a 12% decrease in sort of the total amount of loans that was taken out. They saw their immediate college enrollment rate go up by about 5%, the largest increase in 7 years. So this is really the only statewide evidence we have so far. Which leads me to Salt Lake Community College Promise. This was launched last year. I've been working with Salt Lake Community College to study it, both qualitatively and quantitatively. This is has a need-based component to it. You have to be a Pell Grant recipient. And it's only for full-time. You have to be a full-time degree-seeking student. You also have to meet with an advisor and sort of lock in a degree plan. It's also a last dollar model. So it basically covers whatever Pell Grant won't cover toward tuition. And they're using their institutional aid, basically. They're using their institutional dollars for it. It's still early. We've only been able to look at one semester of outcomes. And so what we did was we compared full-time, first-time Pell Grant students, those who received Promise and those who didn't. This is just our first estimate at this. But you know, we see a slight bump in GPA for those students who received Promise. We don't really see any difference in retention between fall and spring for these students. That's similar to what Tennessee observed. They observed a little bit of a retention difference in fall to fall, one-year retention rather than fall to spring. We also see that these students are enrolling in, on average, in a larger number of credits. These are all full-time students, right? But on average, the Promise students are taking a little bit more credits on average. So just to wrap up here, and then, you know, happy to answer any questions or discussion, you know, I think, you know, particularly because these programs are so new and that the research that we have does not really allow us to look at, you know, differences really for different types of programs, nor does it allow us to really generalize for different designs of programs. What we can do is we can think about some of these designs and think about some of the, what I'll just say, the promises and pitfalls, right? Potential to increase access for students who really otherwise wouldn't go to college, some low-income students, as well as supporting college retention and success, sort of this giving back component, maybe from the perspective of service and other purposes of higher education that aren't just economic. The first dollar model, which is more likely to cover full costs. The pitfalls, the critiques in California right now are that this program is subsidizing a bunch of students who otherwise can pay, you know, millionaires. Those are the headlines, right? Millionaires getting free tuition. So people who would otherwise go to college, the last dollar model, which we've talked about. The other dimension of this is this adds just a really, another layer of complexity to our financial aid system. I know we have some people here from financial aid just, you know, that work at the university, and it's such a complex system. And this adds another layer to sort of how students have to juggle going to college. Revenue sources, I mean, it's all over the place, public, private, a mix of those. Who doesn't benefit? Adult students, undocumented students. Really, this depends on the eligibility requirements that institutions and states are setting. And then the other dimension to this is how this might be shifting enrollment. So in Tennessee, we saw increases in community college enrollment. And, you know, the question is, what happens to those students? What happens to four-year institutions? So just to return back to this question of, you know, really who should pay and why, and I think this question, these models are also, you know, prompting us to think about, do we distribute money equally, regardless of ability to pay, or do we distribute money equitably, sort of accounting for ability to pay, and then as an extension, for what purpose, why, in terms of the private and the public benefits of higher education. So with that, I think Hope has a microphone, and happy to answer any questions or discussion.
Hi. Hi. My name is Lucia Feltovich. I'm a first-year student here studying political science and art.
Awesome.
I was wondering about, so you said that in the Promises part, it supports college retention, but in the Tennessee and the SLIC one, they both showed that retention rates weren't higher, I thought, so I was confused about that. And then I was also wondering, you said that one of the pitfalls is the last dollar model, and so if the pitfall is a last dollar model, why was the last dollar model implemented in the Salt Lake Community College program?
Yeah, great question. So to answer your first question, I think that both Tennessee and Salt Lake data are sort of descriptive. The other, the evidence that we've seen from Kalamazoo and Pittsburgh and Knox Achieves, and actually there's a few other studies as well that use quasi-experimental designs, designs that where we can infer causality, we see bumps in degree completion, college degree completion, which sort of means that, you know, this contributes to students' retention and ultimately degree completion. So, but yeah, I think, you know, your point is a good one. I think, you know, we need to study that a little bit more carefully. And we also have good evidence from other places, other states where we have experimental evidence. Nebraska is a good example. There's a study out of there that actually it's a long standing scholarship, private scholarship program that randomly assigned students aid based on need, and we saw bumps in access and retention. So a little bit different way of thinking about the effect of aid. To answer your second question, has SLIC adopted the last dollar model? Not knowing everything, but knowing a little bit, I would say, one is it's the most affordable option, right? The first dollar model is going to cost more. It's going to cost the institution more. And I think it's a good, it's a safe starting place. I think, you know, institutions who are, and states who are investing in this, I think it's sort of a safe place to start. And I think there are discussions, I know there have been discussions about whether this is the right design or not. And I think as we learn more, as research really is able to tease out the differences between first and last dollar, then we can use that to sort of inform inform practice and policy. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Grace. I'm also a first year undergrad. And I was wondering, has there been any show of help or aid in the disparities from people of color? And because in the beginning it was mentioned the differences in retention rate. Has the retention rate seen any increase?
So that's a great question. I would say first that these, in terms of the design of these programs, they are not considering race, ethnicity in the design. So that is not an explicit eligibility criteria. Now there might be some in the Perna and Lee study. I haven't analyzed. You know, they have 289 programs. I've not gone through all of them. So there might be a few that where that's a consideration. So in terms of the studies that I've seen coming out of Pittsburgh, coming out of Kalamazoo, and coming out of Knox, Achieves, they've not explicitly looked at that, so they've not tested for that. I think we can look descriptively and make some inferences, but I've not seen a lot of direct evidence on that. But I think that's a question I'm answering, you know, going to try to answer with SLIC. The question is, who has access to this, and does this have any differential effect, and independent of income, or actually intersect with income, right? Because we know that income and race, ethnicity don't sort of operate separately. They interact in important ways. So we'll be looking at that. But I've not seen any research that has specifically looked at that. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Juliana Espinosa. I'm an academic advisor here at DU. And one thing that I think is kind of an underlying tone from some of the Promise program that you mentioned was kind of trying to fight a brain drain within that state or that city, right? Because they're trying to incentivize people staying in that. And I'm just wondering if some of the programs also went further and made a connection with like local industry. So in addition to providing this aid, are they also connecting with local businesses and companies as far as providing an additional layer of support, which is career readiness, right?
Yeah.
And like career placement.
Yeah, great question. Mm-hmm. A couple comments on that. One is a few of these early, particularly early Promise programs, and some of the new ones, they do have this community philosophy, and it's about investing, which is good, but it's also problematic in ways where why should we assume that any individual should or wants to stay in that community? So eligibility, you know, is sort of somehow tied to a certain community. And as these programs, you can imagine as these programs multiply, just all of the different conflicts that could emerge. Another layer to that is, I think what Tennessee is doing in terms of community service, right? And I think that's their way of sort of engaging students in the community. And I think that can play out in a lot of different ways. The other layer to that is, I think, you know, there are some, and some of these Promise programs are funded by private sources, and some of those donors are businesses, right? So, I mean, if you look at it from an economic perspective, the businesses are really benefit quite a bit from public higher education, right? Free training. So for businesses, and that's sort of, I mentioned earlier, you know, sort of the private investment, there's something to be said about potentially, you know, getting our community and our business sector to invest in ways. They invest in other ways, right? In terms of employee reimbursement program for education.
Hi, I'm Vlada, and I'm a senior here at the University of Utah. And as many, I don't know, if, I think many of us know that most of universities in Europe are free.
Yeah.
And I was just in Germany for a semester, and my tuition there was 120 euros for a semester. And I would just
120 euros
yes,
per semester?
Yes, for a semester. Okay. And 60 of those euros went towards transportation.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
basically it was free. And I was just wondering, what would it take for us to adopt the same system? Would we have to pay more taxes, or what would it take for us to have that kind of access to college? And the thing is that in Europe, it's I mean, in Germany, it was free both for EU citizens and international students.
Yeah.
So anyone could get this access.
Yeah, great question. And I think, you know, you bring in sort of a comparative perspective. There are a lot of countries, I haven't looked as, you know, I don't know as much about some European countries. I know enough to be dangerous, but there is, you know, the UK is a great example. They had free tuition for a long time, and actually just recently in the past 5 to 10 years, they introduced a fee for students. Australia has a model. It's been a few years since I've looked at this, so I need to probably brush up on it. But they had a model basically where college was free, but you had sort of a tax after you graduated, and it was dependent on your income, right? So the more you made, the more you paid in taxes over a certain period of time. So there are, yeah, we do, I think, see these models in around the globe. What would it take? Yeah, someone has to pay for it, right? The other thing that we haven't really talked about is, you know, in part, is why, what else accounts for the increasing cost of college, right? It's a really complex question, but, you know, will we assume that the price and the cost of college will continue to rise? And if so, that means, you know, we need revenue sources. And so, you know, in California, this would be an increase in tax in order to fund students. There might be other ways to do it creatively. You know, the question I would ask is, okay, well, what happens during recessions when tax dollars run dry? This is happening in Oregon, announced their program. They underestimated how much it would cost, and now there's talk of reducing the eligibility requirement, or limiting the eligibility requirements so fewer students have access, right? So how can we think about this in a way where we have some stability over time, right? Because really it's students who are left in this position, sort of this really unclear, unstable circumstance.
My name is Melissa. I just had a question about what there is in the way of graduate programs and funding for that. Mm.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I can answer that. Certainly, I would say all of the literature I've seen on promise programs is concentrated at the undergraduate level. I've not seen any, at least in this new manifestation of promise programs. I've not seen anything at the state or local level that has invested in graduate education like these programs are investing in undergraduate. That doesn't mean they don't exist, though. What about second bachelors? That's a good question. a lot of these programs will restrict eligibility to only 2 years of college or 4 years of college. Sometimes there's a maximum dollar amount, like $30,000, for example. I think that's the case in the New York program. So depending on where you are and what program you're in, they may or may not, but I would guess it's more likely not. It's more likely that they won't fund a second bachelor's. All right, Hope's coming around with the microphone here. Yep.
Hi, Denise Brennis. I'm an advisor on campus. I was just wondering in regards, I guess, in particularly New York, where it's in the budget,
yeah.
Are they then saying to universities or mandating you can only increase tuition by this much, uh-huh. Or is it just kind of, we're not going to get into that mess, we're just going to focus on tuition and fees. Does that make sense?
Yeah, the question, that's a great question, right? What impact in part will this have on institutional behavior and increasing tuition? Will we see any effect? So this is one of the arguments in terms of why college costs so much, right? It's called the Bennett hypothesis, that that one of the reasons why tuition has gone up is because more money is available in terms of loan dollars and aid, and so that prompts institutions to raise their tuition rates. And you know, there's conflicting evidence on that, but I've not seen any provisions that tie these grant programs to institutional tuition policy. But I could certainly see them emerging. Good question. All right, I know these, okay, one back here, and then I know you all have had your hand raised for a while. Yeah.
My name's Carla, and I'm actually a transfer from Queens College, so one of the CUNY
awesome.
Schools.
Great.
And I think it's great that they're giving free tuition for lower income students, but it's just kind of, I transferred to the U because I thought that the living expenses here are a little bit cheaper. The mm-hmm. University of Utah is a really great school. But what about the students who already went to that school, graduated, or for the rest of America who already have that debt? Is there anything in the making for to help those students out with those student loans in the future?
Yeah, if I'm understanding partially where you're coming from is, partially this is about the eligibility, and a lot of these programs restrict eligibility. They're place-based, right? You have to be a resident, you have to be in this community to receive this benefit. And then in some cases, as New York, you know, you have to stay here after you graduate. But what about all the other students? And I think that's part of the concern of the emergence of these programs is that you're gonna continue to have more haves and haves and have-nots in terms of who can access these benefits and who can't access these benefits. I think the argument that, you know, a policymaker might make is that, okay, these are our local tax dollars. If we're investing these, we need to think about only supporting our local students, not students from out of state. So maybe we should think about programs that allow transferability across state. Half of all students who receive a bachelor's degree attend a community college. 24% of transfer students transfer across state lines. We've got a lot of mobility in American higher education. And so we've got these programs that are thinking very locally and in isolated ways. So it's concerning. I don't have an answer other than that we sort of have a cacophony of policies that are emerging. I know these three up here have been waiting for a while.
All right, so we have time for a couple more questions. And okay. If you have questions afterwards, you're welcome to talk to Dr. Taylor as well.
Hi, I'm Savannah, and I'm a first-year ELP student, and I'm also an academic advisor on Main Campus, or actually in Health Sciences, not Main Campus. But I was just thinking about the question you asked about who should pay for college, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And getting back to that general idea, and I was wondering if there's been any research about the ramifications of just making college free for everyone, because, for example, in Brazil, there's free higher education,
mm-hmm.
but it basically has flipped the issue, and you have to go to a private high school that costs just as much as college would in the US
mm-hmm.
in order to be competitive enough to get the test scores to get into the free colleges.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so I was just wondering if people have thought about that at all and how that would affect like higher ed in the US if we just made it free for everyone.
Yeah, great question. I think part of what you're getting at is the unintended consequences of these policies, which we're starting to learn a little bit about what those are. One of them is sort of where students enroll and how this might shift. You know, Tennessee's an example. How does this shift enrollment from the four-year sector to the two-year sector? And I think, like a lot of policies, we don't know what the unintended consequences are until we sort of observe them and are able to research them. So I think there's a robust debate about that. I can't answer your question from a comparative perspective. I don't know, but I think I think as we see free college and the idea of free college and promise programs really emerging and proliferating in the United States, we need to look at our global neighbors and see. And there are key differences, though, between some of those countries, right? Where we might learn, it might not tell us as much as we think, but we should be thinking comparatively now. Yeah. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Kristen Mahoney. I'm also an academic program manager here for Health Sciences. I actually just moved here from Tennessee.
Oh, great.
So I kind of have a two-part comment/question.
Yeah.
I worked at a nonprofit in Tennessee, uh-huh. and we did see a significant bump in volunteers. When the Promise program started. So I was curious if anyone has done any research on that side of the Tennessee Promise program. And then the other part is just before we moved, they were discussing expanding eligibility to returning adults.
Yeah.
Adults with some college but have not finished a degree. And from what I understand, there's a significant population in Utah of people who have some college but not a degree. And I was wondering if there's any stirrings of that conversation here.
Oh, great questions. To answer your first one, I think, is this the last question? Because I think we're running up against the clock here. There are a lot of people who are doing research on Tennessee Promise. I've not seen any. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist. I've not seen any research on the volunteer dimension, the community service dimension, but I think we need to study that and think about the value of that. So I don't know any off the top of my head, but I know there's some underway based on some colleagues that are working on it. The other thing to answer your second question, yes, Tennessee now has, they call it the Adult Reconnect program, and they've basically expanded free college to all anyone who has some who went to college, and then they're trying to get them to come back. Right, we've got about 32 million people in the United States with some college, no degree. About a fifth of all adults, working age adults in the United States, have some college, no degree. So we've got a huge institutions do. They're really good at recruiting freshmen and transfer students, but once a student leaves, we don't invest in getting students to return. I think that's another. That's sort of the adult population. So we'll see how that works over time. So, yeah.
All right. Please join me in thanking Dr. Jason Taylor for the interesting and informative forum.
Thanks.
Jason Taylor is an assistant professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy at the University of Utah. He researches the so-called free college movement and current policy efforts to make college more affordable. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.